Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.8. There goes the train. How about that? What a great way to start off this episode. You just hear the train going by. That's what I have to deal with. That's why I need a studio. And you guys are actually contributing towards that goal on Patreon. In case you didn't know, when I get to 7.5 grand, if that even happens in this universe, if I get to 7.5 grand a month, I will get a studio so that I don't have to pause every time the train goes by. But there you go. I'm definitely going to leave that in. Just to give you guys an idea of the, well, exactly how hard my life is sometimes. I'm just kidding. This is great. I've been having great fun doing the Versailles Anniversary Project. And then it's kind of nice to delve into this stuff here with 1956 and remind myself, yeah, the British did some pretty crazy things even after the whole Versailles malarkey was over with. So today we are going to investigate some of that craziness. Last time we learned a great deal about the scheming and the military planning, with all its faults in the Anglo-French case. We also saw how the British and French were content to get the US on side, but they were also prepared to go it alone if this proved unnecessary. John Foster Dulles, oblivious at this early stage to the fact that the armed intervention against Nasser's Egypt had been approved by the 17th of August, was content to urge an international conference to take place just the day before, on the 16th of August. In this episode, we're going to see what came of these efforts to defuse the situation, and we'll also examine the debate in Britain and by historians regarding Britain's legal rights in the Suez matter. Since the Suez Canal Company was a business registered in Egypt, was Nasser breaking any international law by nationalizing it? Well, the fact that Britain and France were on shaky legal ground didn't help matters, and they were forced to underline other key aspects of the incident instead. As August and September wore on, we'll see an Anglo-French establishment drawn closer and closer together as D-Day approached. Let's investigate then, as I take you all to 1956. The cabinet agreed that we should be on weak ground in basing our resistance on the narrow argument that Colonel Nasser had acted illegally. The Suez Canal Company was registered as an Egyptian company under Egyptian law, and Colonel Nasser had indicated that he intended to compensate the shareholders at ruling market prices. From a narrow legal point of view, his action amounted to no more than a decision to buy out the shareholders. Our case must be presented on wider international grounds. This extract from the minutes of the British Cabinet on the 27th of July 1956 tells several stories. The most interesting to me is the concept that Anthony Eden's government was on shaky legal ground. And I find it interesting because not only is this aspect of the Suez Crisis rarely talked about, but Eden and his peers clearly knew it to be true. In fact, it was because they knew that the actual act Nasser had committed, that of nationalizing a company which was registered to a country that he ruled, it was because they knew that this was not illegal that they emphasized instead the circumstances surrounding the act, and they dressed the nationalization up with such emotive language so as to cast Nasser as the villain who had committed an unspeakable crime. Recasting Nasser's admittedly bullish but not illegal action as that of a criminal's quest to usurp the international order and threaten the interests of all civilized states, Eden's government hoped to garner sympathy from these states, and he surely hoped at the same time that nobody would look too closely at the act or the British protest. Any close examination of the affair would surely demonstrate that Nasser had acted within his legal rights. Indeed, the historian Geoffrey Marston noted that Eden couldn't find any lawyer specializing in international law to come out and say that what Nasser had done was inherently wrong. Eventually, a good, patriotic Brit did come forward. His name was Professor Arthur Goodhart, the Master of Oxford, who also happened to write for The Times, that organ of the Tory establishment. Goodhart's connections suggested that he was likely to see things Eden's way, and indeed, his piece written for The Times on the 11th of August captured the argument in favour of Britain's rights, while still acknowledging, however tacitly, that Britain was on shaky legal ground. Goodhart wrote, "Finally, it has been said that under modern international law, force must never be used except to repel a direct territorial attack. This view cannot be accepted, as the use of force is not so limited. Thus, for example, a state may take all necessary steps to protect the lives of its citizens abroad. Similarly, it may use force to protect a vital national interest which has been imperiled. In such a case, it is the state that has altered the status quo by the use of force which is guilty of aggression. The minutes of one of many heady cabinet meetings throughout August 1956 emphasised this argument made in the Times, almost as if to prove that the secret policy of armed intervention did have some adherence in the scholars of international law. In particular, we're drawn to a meeting on the 28th of August, wherein the government's position, complete with all the different options and variables, was laid out in stark terms. The minutes read, "While force should be the last resort, it was a weapon which we should not shrink from using if need arose. It would be wrong to disregard the United Nations, but it would be equally wrong to allow the real issue to be eroded by ineffective international debate. As soon as we were satisfied that a just settlement could not be secured through the machinery of the United Nations, we should ourselves take other steps to secure it. Apart from any consideration of self-interest, we had a strong case, morally and in international law. We were entitled to see that it prevailed. If it could not be made to prevail by peaceful means, we should be resolved to impose it by force. It had been well stated by Professor Goodhart in a letter published in the Times on the 11th of August that there was no foundation for the view that under modern international law, force might be used only to repel a direct territorial attack. A state might properly use force to protect a vital national interest which had been imperiled, and in such a case, it was the state which had altered the status quo which was guilty of aggression." There it was. International law be damned, or at least manipulated, because Eden's government believed that the use of force to defend one's vital interests was a perfectly acceptable policy, even while vital interests were a dime a dozen in post-war Britain. These minutes on the 28th of August demonstrate that, in the mind of the cabinet, the other options had already been exhausted and force had been already settled upon. Even if it wasn't stated outright that Britain was planning to intervene militarily in Egypt, we know that by this point, an Anglo-French joint approval for war with Egypt was already secured. From the very beginning, though, and even as early as late March 1956, when Nasser's antics had worn out his patience and thoroughly embarrassed him, Eden had become fixated on the idea of intervention in Egypt. His first memo to President Eisenhower, following the first cabinet meeting on the nationalisation crisis on the 27th of July, testifies to this resolve. Eden wrote to Eisenhower saying that, "We should not allow ourselves to become involved in legal quibbles about the rights of the Egyptian government to nationalise what is technically an Egyptian company, or in financial arguments about their capacity to pay the compensation which they have offered. I feel sure that we should take issue with Nasser on the broader international grounds. My colleagues and I are convinced that we must be ready, in the last resort, to use force to bring Nasser to his senses. For our part, we are prepared to do so. I have this morning instructed our chiefs of staff to prepare a military plan accordingly." The last resort was in fact the favoured option, yet it would have been impolitique for Eden to say what he really meant. In other words, that Nasser had embarrassed him, that Eden was sick of Britain's rights being denied, that Eden and several of his peers were still living in the old times of glory and had failed to get with the new programme, that Eden felt his career and legacy in jeopardy if he did not stand up to the Egyptian usurper soon. Eden's declaration that we should not allow ourselves to become involved in legal quibbles was a sly way of saying that international law would not restrict Britain's freedom of action. In addition, Eden's mention here of compensation reminds us of another fact about Nasser's action that is also often glossed over. While he had seized the Suez Canal Company's assets, he by no means intended to leave its shareholders out of pocket. On the contrary, Nasser had immediately moved to compensate them, in effect buying the shares of the company's shareholders and removing all vestiges of foreign ownership. Nasser neglected to mention that he was compensating the shareholders during the course of his fiery nationalistic speech, but in reality he did not want to give any disgruntled shareholders any excuse to agitate back home. By compensating the shareholders from the get-go, paying them what their shares were worth according to the French stock market measurements on the 26th of July, Nasser was left with a large initial bill, but he was thereafter on secure legal ground. He had used force in public, but in private he had abided by the law. The British response, incidentally, was to take the polar opposite approach. Nasser's willingness to compensate the shareholders and refrain from restricting any international shipping placed Eden in a difficult spot. The antagonistic, belligerent, villainous President Nasser, well, he didn't look so bad after all. Sure, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, could agree that the forceful way in which Egyptian troops had entered the offices of the Suez Canal Company was impolitique, vowing that he would help the Anglo-French governments to achieve satisfaction, but the more Dulles looked at it, the more he came to appreciate that the Anglo-French governments were angry because they had been outsmarted and embarrassed, rather than because they had been genuinely wronged. Nasser would have been more than happy to continue on as normal. It can hardly be said that he wanted a war with the British and French, whatever his nationalistic rhetoric may have indicated. As August progressed, Eden's initially stiff stance, which had been so popular with his peers and the public alike, began to falter. It wasn't that Eden stopped insisting privately for a military solution, but that his peers began to doubt whether it was such a good idea after all. Having initially been caught up in the heat of the moment, the more they thought about it, the more many backbenchers and members of Eden's own cabinet began to discern the problems involved in acting aggressively. There was also the problem that the more time which passed, the less and less any Anglo-French action would appear as an understandable knee-jerk reaction rather than a conspiratorial plot. The former option, to act quickly in response to Nasser's nationalisation, would still have been problematic in terms of international law, but at least it would have been launched quickly when the nationalisation was fresh in everyone's minds. However, by taking over 2.5 months to prepare the intervention, the Anglo-French governments appeared more like scheming imperialists rather than disgruntled powers with genuine grievances. Worse for Eden and for French Premier Guy Mollet, the period of waiting and preparing in secret necessitated them lying their heads off to their American allies, an act which hardly garnered any sympathy in Washington by the time their behaviour was out in the open for all the world to see. Anticipating these problems, some members of Eden's cabinet began to urge a more conciliatory approach to Egypt, or at least for Eden to tone down a bit of the rhetoric. Yet, Eden could not do this. On the 8th of August, he had appeared on television, opening the broadcast unnaturally with an introduction of "My Friends," and adding, "The pattern is familiar to many of us. We know this is how fascist governments behave, and we all remember only too well what the cost can be in giving in to fascism." Eden promised that an act of plunder which threatens the livelihood of many nations will not be allowed to succeed. The problem with this performance, other than Eden's unnatural efforts to appeal to his viewers as something akin to his friends, was the inherent lie within the declaration. Nasser's act to nationalise the canal company had been brazen for sure, but he hadn't been stupid enough to restrict or endanger any shipping interests which the concerned nations of the world, who used the canal regularly, may have had. This is a point we keep coming back to, but it's worth emphasising again. Eden was lost in his efforts to hark back to a darker time in world history, and he was keen to paint Nasser's actions in the most darkly familiar light that he could. By presenting the action not as a singular act, but as the first provocative action in a long list to come, Eden could bring back to life that old chestnut of appeasement, and argue from that emotive platform that Nasser should be opposed now, or else in the future he would do something truly dangerous, and by then it would be too late to stop him. It was a tactic as desperate as it was potentially effective. Eden had made his name as an arch anti-appeaser after all, and it was a safe rhetorical haven to retreat to because nobody could prove that Nasser wasn't harbouring grander, more dangerous ambitions to expand his Egyptian domains. However, while some of his colleagues had bought wholly into this line, some were also growing weary of Eden's constant need to bring up the past. As Rab Butler, the Lord Privy Seal in Eden's cabinet, noted vividly after watching Eden's televised address, "I remember leaning out of the bow window into the garden and smoking one of the last cigarettes I ever had. My mood was one of deep misgiving and anxiety on hearing this analogy with fascism and the personalization of Nasser. I thought the Prime Minister had got that part of it wrong. I admired his courage, his gallantry, his wartime record, and his Foreign Office achievements. He seemed thoroughly in character in standing up for British rights in the Middle East, and I supported him. But it was surely unwise to use in 1956 the language that ought to have been used in 1936. the circumstances had altered and the cast had changed. The cast was indeed completely different, and unlike the Nazi Germany of 1936, Nasser's ambitions for Egyptian expansion in terms of the canal did cease with the nationalization of its company. He was not about to impose restrictions on anyone. The Egyptian president even lifted the initial measure, which stipulated that any foreign employees of the company who tried to leave would be arrested. Nasser adhered wholeheartedly to the 1888 Convention on the Suez Canal, which Dulles' upcoming conference was supposed to discuss. It was already clear, even before Eden had denounced him on British television, that Nasser wouldn't attend that conference, though. The Egyptian president told the American ambassador, after spending the day with his children on the beach and going to a movie to clear his mind, that he had no intentions of travelling to what had become enemy territory. While Nasser relaxed with his family then, Eden worked himself into a tizzy and had given the impression that the whole British government was, in the words of one biting critic, in the hands of a weak man who was trying to prove that he is a strong one. Yet Nasser did not simply ignore the fact that several countries were about to discuss what was now his canal. The American ambassador recorded to Washington some of Nasser's comments on the looming conference. He thought the choice of nations was very strange and composed for the large of satellites of the big three. How, for instance, was Ethiopia chosen? The combination of the Commonwealth and close friends and allies of the United States left little doubt that the conference would be pro forma. The British would put in a paper and a great majority of the others would quickly agree with very little discussion or consideration of Egypt's case. So the Egyptian president was to no-show the conference, yet the American ambassador in Cairo added another pillar to Nasser's firm foundations when he wrote home that Nasser was, so he claimed, ready to sign a new international agreement, guaranteeing freedom of passage and uninterrupted use of Suez Canal facilities. Colonel Nasser was hardly a Hitler, especially since he was opening his doors to freedom of access, and apart from Israel, no state would be prevented from continuing as normal. Nasser's declarations undermined the Anglo-French moral high ground. All they had by the end of August was the distant memory of Nasser's swift seizure of a company registered in his own country. Other states were cautiously coming to accept the new order as well, and tolls were being paid in full, just as the insurance companies were fulfilling their end of the bargain at the same time. The event could have passed into the echelons of history, but for a few important niggling details. Neither Eden nor his French counterpart had gained any kind of satisfaction as August rolled on, either in military or diplomatic terms. In the fortnight or so before the conference took place, it was important that as much hurt feelings were aired as possible in an effort to put some pressure onto Washington. Yet Eden was discovering that in John Foster Dulles he had something close to an ally, if only because of Dulles's profound distaste at Nasser's acquisition of Soviet arms in a trade deal made with Moscow the previous year. The Joint Chiefs sent out a warning through the relevant departments on the 3rd of August to the effect that as Nasser's influence spreads, it may be anticipated that other Arab states will use his successful act of nationalization as justification for themselves expropriating US and Western enterprises. This was in spite of the fact that the nationalism and ambitions of other such Arab leaders was far less developed, nor did any other Arab state have such a recognizable and symbolic landmark as Nasser did with the canal. Yet there was another canal, the Panama Canal, which the United States was heavily invested in and which it depended upon for its own interests. The situation mirrored that of the Suez Canal in the British sense to an uncomfortable degree in Eisenhower's mind, and he was of the uncompromising opinion that if we left the Panama Zone, we would take the locks with us. Yet once again, there was no indication that in Panama, a similar effort was underway as that which Nasser had initiated, nor would the Panama government dare to defy the United States when Washington resided literally on its doorstep. The situations were different, but the similarities were still sufficient to get the State Departments back against the wall. Dulles' special assistant and main advisor on the Middle East, George Russell, was absolutely of the opinion that something concrete needed to be done in the Suez situation, not necessarily because Nasser had nationalized the canal company, but because this nationalization was only the most recent in a long list of diplomatic crimes already committed by the Egyptian president. Where Eden had warned of what might come in the future, George Russell was more than happy to list off to his superior the amount of times when Nasser had repeatedly left American interests on the wrong foot. He wrote to John Foster Dulles of this list of crimes, beginning with, Nasser's efforts to build a solidarity of the Arab countries, especially Egypt, Saudi Arabia and Syria, even at the expense of economic progress in Egypt, his rage at Iraq's participation in the Baghdad Pact, his lip service in private talks to a Palestinian settlement while exacerbating the problem in public speeches, his firm insistence upon obtaining the entire Negev region, his skill, for a period at least, in playing the Soviet bloc against the West, his shrewdness in dealing at one time with Britain and another time with the United States, but rarely the two at the same time, his public dispatch of Ambassador Hussein to accept the United States' offer to assist on the Aswan Dam after having shown no interest for 6 months, at a time when he was aware that the Secretary of State was no longer in a position to make firm arrangements, and finally, using the turn down as a pretext for seizing the canal, and thus, if successful, putting Egypt in a position to affect the economy of Western Europe, the countries of South Asia, and elsewhere. George Russell's flurry here would have left Anthony Eden immensely pleased, if he had ever read it, but this list of crimes was only observed by Secretary Dulles, and he did not comment either way on Nasser's duplicity or cynicism in the past. What the Secretary did note was that this divergence of approach between us and the British and French does not by any means imply that we will not be solidly with them if the conference method breaks down. Dulles, in short, wasn't going all in. He was willing to give diplomacy a chance, but he was far from leaving the Anglo-French camp to its own devices, or giving Nasser any hint as to where Washington would stand in the event of armed conflict. Of course, what Dulles assumed by taking this stance was that the Anglo-French camp would work within the confines of the conference, and that they would see that it worked properly. He does not seem to have imagined that they would regard the conference processes with such private scorn, because he was not yet aware of the covert military plans, which were well in the offing in the first half of August. In France, the public mood became still more hostile as the conference loomed. The normally leftist newspaper, Le Monde, commented that France would have to act to topple Nasser, even if this meant acting alone. In throwing down this challenge, the French editorial noted, the Egyptian government is testing the cohesion of the West's diplomatic and military machinery. Everything will now depend on the speed and determination with which the Western nations are able to take retaliatory measures. Some French editorials even had an anti-American flavour, where it was hinted that the Americans lacked gumption and honour because they threatened now to abandon France in her hour of need, where the French had stood by Washington since 1945. Yet, if the French were hardening amongst themselves, then British opinion was fracturing. The Labour Party had given its approval to Eden's government since the crisis began, thundering about the same principles of security and national interests that Eden had parroted. As August progressed, though, it became harder to discern exactly where the different Labour MPs, or even some of Eden's own backbenchers, would stand. While force cannot be excluded, noted the Labour Party leader, Hugh Gaitskell, we must be sure that circumstances justify it and that it is consistent with the UN Charter. The United Nations was very low down the list of considerations in Eden's cabinet, though, and Gaitskell was becoming disturbed by rumours repeated to him in the first week of August. Gaitskell said he didn't believe it, remembered a colleague, because Eden couldn't be so reckless and foolish. Keeping Labour leader Gaitskell in the dark proved to be a grave mistake on Eden's part, not least because, by the time the truth came out, the Labour leader was so enraged that he launched a series of attacks that were the most powerful speeches I had ever heard in the Commons, according to a witness at the time. For his part, Gaitskell recalled once the truth came out in early November that I shall never believe anything that Eden says to me again, in public or in private. Eden would soon be picked apart by his political rival, but in August at least, while Gaitskell was in the dark, he had his public support. Gaitskell continued to converse with Eden in private, warning him in no uncertain terms that neither he nor the public could countenance a straight-up military intervention in Egypt. Eden absorbed the advice, but he knew deep down that the policy was already made. Behind the scenes, Eden and his peers were desperately trying to find some kind of casus belli to batter Nasser with. The minutes of the meeting in Cabinet from the 14th of August recorded that. In discussion, it was suggested that, although it could be argued that Colonel Nasser's seizure of the Suez Canal and his enforced retention of the employees of the Suez Canal Company justified the use of force, such action would be unlikely to obtain general support without some further cause being provided by the Egyptian government. A departmental official in the Foreign Office even drew up a paper entitled Why the Egyptian Action in Nationalizing the Suez Canal is Illegal. Yet, if one looked at the actual details of the document, in the margin notes it read, "This is not a considered legal opinion, but was intended to give us talking points at the conference." Britain's stumbling and backpedaling was close to breathtaking, yet Eden's government had a conference to prepare for on the 16th of August, and they had to do something, even if privately they spurned the idea of such a device. Eden's government was desperate for Nasser to do something, anything, to justify intervention, since it was clear that an attack in collusion with the French would have been widely condemned the longer the drama went on. It was becoming the mission of Whitehall to develop some kind of excuse. Foreign Secretary Selwyn Lloyd put it the following way on the 20th of August. "In the first place, it will be no doubt realised that however illegal the Egyptian action in purporting to nationalise the Suez Canal Company may be, it is not, in itself and as things stand at present, of such a character as would, under international law, afford a legal justification for armed intervention, nor would international law afford any justification for the use of force merely in order to impose an international regime for the canal, unless certain further Egyptian action had occurred." The aspect of the Suez crisis which was incendiary wasn't necessarily the fact that Eden and Malay's governments endeavoured, throughout this period, to make the use of force through some measure or another seem legitimate. Instead, it was the fact that when the time came, the use of force was dressed up as an Anglo-French intervention taken to preserve the interests of the free world by securing the Suez Canal. This Anglo-French intervention in the name of securing and protecting the canal's integrity was made possible because by the time the British and French did intervene in early November, Israel and Egypt were in a state of war, and there was immense international confusion about what was actually happening on the ground. You'll notice then that Eden's goals with respect to Suez changed as time went on. The Prime Minister at first wanted a straightforward intervention in Egypt to claw back British prestige, secure British interests and control over the canal, and of course, stick it to President Nasser. Yet as August became September and Nasser was still being good as gold, the plot thickened and the decision to dress up the armed intervention as an Anglo-French act of selflessness, of the use of force in the name of delicate international markets and the interests of other peace-loving states while those two states over there made war, became the mission instead. Making use of the war between Egypt and Israel was so controversial and such a stunningly cynical policy for British government in the 20th century to take, precisely because the whole thing had been prearranged. Israel had acted in league with Britain and France, and it was no happy accident that Israel muddied the waters in Egypt at the exact moment Eden and his French counterpart required a new excuse to get involved. The scandal, pretty much the crux of the Suez crisis and what makes it all so incredibly fascinating, if a bit demoralising and breathtaking and every other negative word you can think of, was doubly explosive, and it was doubly insulting to men like Labour leader Hugh Gaitskell, who had first been lied to by Eden about any notion of planning a military strike against Nasser, and had then been lied to and manipulated again when Selwyn Lloyd and Anthony Eden both went before Parliament and claimed that they were acting in Egypt with the peace of the world in mind. Now, we don't want to go too far ahead with our story here, but spoiler alert if you didn't know that this was where the story was going, it is worth noting that on the 5th of November 1956, Selwyn Lloyd lied to the faces of the opposition and many of the backbenchers opposite when he noted that Britain and France continue to believe that it is necessary to interpose an international force to prevent the continuance of hostilities between Egypt and Israel, to secure the speedy withdrawal of Israeli forces, to take the necessary measures to remove obstructions and restore traffic to the Suez Canal, and to promote a settlement of the problems of the area. Because the United Nations resolution for such a measure had not been accepted, though, the excuse would be given that the British and French were already on the scene and would use their advantageous position to do the right thing. It was convenient, they were already there, and they knew the region well and they knew exactly what to do to make everyone happy. So don't worry about this, United Nations, we've got this covered. Eden would deny any notions of collusion with Israel, an aspect of the story I am very much looking forward to covering until the end of time. He literally took the denial to his grave. Yet, thanks to the release of previously classified documents after the expiration of the 30-year rule in 1986, the truth emerged with a scandalous degree of clarity. In the minutes of the cabinet meetings throughout September, we can even see Eden and his peers start to theorise about turning their energies towards such an end. On the 11th of September, the minutes of a cabinet meeting put it that it would be mistaken to assume that if force had ultimately to be used, this would be inconsistent with the United Nations Charter. While the detailed provisions of the Charter placed all their emphasis on the preservation of peace, it was one of the essential purposes of the Charter, as reflected in the preamble, to secure respect for international obligations. It was this which was the main issue at stake in the situation. So peace and the respect for international obligations could be used as excuses for intervention, and all under the cloak of the United Nations Charter. How about that? It all sounded too good to be true. Eden could have his interventionist cake and eat it, so long as intervention was framed in the right way. He added to the minutes on the 11th of September that every reasonable effort must be made to secure this objective, i.e. the effective international control over the canal, by peaceful means, but that if these should all fail, we shall be justified in the last resort in using force to restore the situation. Of course, this new trend in Eden's thinking only took place after the conference originally proposed by Dulles had taken place. Before Eden and his peers altered their tune to create the same song, they first had to keep up appearances by making it appear as though they believed in the power of international conferences to restore order and justice. A few days before the conference was due to meet on the 16th of August, Eden fired off another letter to Eisenhower. Its content and tone showed that even while the Prime Minister may have been aware that things weren't proceeding as he had hoped with respect to Egypt, he was far from willing to give up on this straightforward policy of covert intervention. Eden wrote, "I am sure you will agree that we must prepare to meet the eventuality that Nasser will refuse to accept the outcome of the conference, or, no less dangerous, that he, supported by the Russians, will seek by stratagems and wiles to divide us, so that the conference produces no clear result in the sense we both seek. We and the French government could not possibly acquiesce in such a situation. I really believe that the consequences of doing so would be catastrophic, and that the whole position in the Middle East would thereby be lost beyond recall. But by all means, let us first see what the conference can do, on the assumption that Nasser commits no further folly meanwhile." Now, I know I said we'd look at the Canal Conference today, but since we've already covered a great deal of content, next time we'll open the episode with an examination of this 22-nation Canal Users Conference in London, as we see precisely what the solutions to the Egyptian problem were, and how Eden sought to make the most use out of them without removing the need for force. I hope you'll join me then, and I hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of 1956. Until next time, my lovely patrons, sometime in mid-January, my name is Zach. This has been 1956, episode 2.8. Thanks so much for listening. Have a brilliant Christmas and holidays and everything else, and I'll be seeing you all soon.